Hey there.
Hey Rand, good to have you back. Skype froze over there, so I'll cut this little snippet
This is an
out.
edit. This is an edit. We just had an edit. I don't know what happened. It just all of a sudden you froze. And
Here we are.
it wouldn't stop freezing. So anyway, an
I know
edit
pretty
mode.
much where we were, so I'll cut this little segment out when I edit it, and then we will just go. So I was just describing. So carry on from here. We have a strategy, Rand, that takes out the reaction element. So given the discussion what we have had about the emotional responses, one of the ways certainly to help manage the emotional response and that I've highlighted about the HVF methodology is that whilst rational and unengaged in the market, with only a pending order that may or may not get triggered in the direction that we think, and if it doesn't, we're not in and there's no loss, we assess at what point we will take money off in the events of profits that is determined geometrically, and where the stop loss is, which is a lot earlier because we're making use of volatility squeeze. So it's one of those rare moments where you can justify being tight. All that is predetermined, and both the entry and either options of exit, plus there's a time stop if you did trigger, but then you were listing and you weren't being stopped out or making the targets required. That would eventually close it and say the original justification for the move has had countervailing forces come in that has held it up. This takes away a lot of the need on the hoof to have to make instant decisions when you are being challenged with a current market event. In other words, the game is to stick to process now, and in many instances, I encourage people to actively not be present when the trade is run in or closed on stop or closed on target, on the basis that it has no difference whether
Right.
they're watching it or not. It is something they have no power over, and they're more likely to get emotionally provoked and tempted to break with process in the beginning than if they are just passively non-available. It does also show and prove a different way, a path for people, and they start to get comfortable with that. And they say, look, it's moving against me, but hey, I stick to process. They slowly become converts and greater believers in process than one individual trade. Just in terms of that, while I'm not looking for endorsement from you, do you have a comment in terms of actively designing a strategy that reduces the need for on-the-hoof impulse reactions?
Well, you've actually said the magic words is that your system tends to focus on process. And, your job is to carry out process, which is, by the way, something you can control. Okay? Instead of going and trying to control outcome, which is when that's where the triggering, that's where all that triggering of emotion happens when it starts going against you and, suddenly anger shows up and you're going to get them back and you begin revenge trading, or fear shows up, and all of a sudden you get out of a perfectly good trade. So, yeah, what you're doing, and what I like about what you're doing, is you are taking a lot of the elements that provoke emotions. You're minimizing their effect, and that's more power to you. It's a
It's kind of what I say is we're working on the same problem from two different ends.
yeah.
You and I think both are required, because if you've got to eat your way through a Puckman through a bunch of dots, it helps to start from both ends. But many people don't do either. And by minimizing the requirement for on the hoof decision making, we are giving people more time to learn to cope with market behavior and to designate the trust to process. And then discussing what you're doing is if you're in that situation and you are watching it and you are feeling emotional, here's how you deal with it more actively. A, recognize it early and
Yeah.
catch it before the turbos have spooled up and you go into eruption where you actually need the blow-off event just to release all this energy that has been created. Let's carry on with your side of things. It just was an interesting analogy and I wanted to bring it in because it's an interesting thought. the nature of the strategy is trying to deal with the same demons. And it has me wonder, is this not where the crux of all trading lies?
To me, the crux of all trading lies at the moment of where you have a system that's built to control outcome. That's what survival instincts are all about. You're controlling self-preservation, outcomes. You're controlling your sense of power, your ability to make things happen in an environment. And on a higher level, you're also trying to control status. Look at me. Aren't I an influencer? When you start listening to all these guys in trade rooms and they're trying to show how bravado they are, those three key elements are going to happen because they're biological, they're tribal, and they're not going to go away. Ultimately, though, when faced with trading, you're put into a situation where it's all probability. There, you realize that the notion of control of outcome is an illusion.
Correct.
And Einstein said, well, it's an illusion, but it's a very persistent illusion. It's still an illusion, and it gets you into an enormous difficulty in trading. And I can't tell you how many guys who come in from businesses, from corporate, where they've done very well, they've been the alpha, they've won, you know, it's all about winning, and they think they're in control. Mm. They get into trading, and they try to take the same thing that's produced success in that other domain into trading, and it blows up in their face. They're the ones who chase trading. They're the ones who end up all this revenge trading. They want to control outcome. They want to control everything. Ultimately, though, they have to acknowledge that this is not the game, is that this is a probability-based game where the outcomes are uncertain.
Yeah.
And what you're doing is you're having to rebuild a mind that can manage that.
Yeah.
And what you're doing with your strategy, you're moving toward going, okay, let's minimize the damage that the emotional brain can do by taking some of that stuff out and having these preset places. You know, ultimately, I actually like that simply because it really particularly it gives you a lot more. It gives you some cushion about the way emotions happen. And ultimately, though, it comes down to how do we manage the emotion once we're there? Let me give you an example of this, Francis. I work with a very hardworking student, and he's gone from really blowing up all the time to where, you know, he's moved into three contracts, he's making some good money, and then all of a sudden he starts falling apart again. Okay? And in his methodology, the moment that he's in the trade, orders filled, there are 5 3-minute bars that show up that will tell him precisely if he needs to be in that trade because it's high probability or whether or not he's made a mistake and needs to take a small loss. It's just real factual. Boom, boom, boom. Very little ambiguity in that. Yet, what his pattern was, the tendency was, is that he would hit that third bar. And, you know, his methodology is telling him take a small loss. But there was something in him that says, I'm going to give it a little room. Hmm. This is what you're trying to avoid with your strategy. I'm going to give it some room. He gives it room and it just gobbles that up. Okay. And then he really triggers and he starts throwing money thinking it's going to come back. It's going to come back. Ultimately, what's happening here is it's just not the emotion taking over. What's happening here is the belief system behind that emotion. This is the big deal. In that belief system with this particular trader, he believes that he is not good enough. And he's a CPA. He had to work really hard. He said, you know, I'm really not the sharpest arrow in the quiver, but the truth is, I'm going to outwork anybody and I'm going to win because I work hard.
Yeah.
That's his philosophy.
Yeah.
Don't lose, win. And I'm going to work hard to do it.
And people make a successful life out of diligence, and it becomes quite understandably persistency, because in most things it works.
Absolutely.
If you keep showing up, eventually you acquire the skill. But it is still a jackhammer or a nutcracker, and every time you get it, you're assuming everything is a nut. And I think where you're taking us is that, you know, pushing hard enough on the lever doesn't give you the success in trading and the probability. In fact, it's counterproductive.
In trading, what you discover is that instead of it being a big fish in a small pond where hard work matters, you're a minnow, a small fish in a vast ocean where your existence is not even noticed by the market.
Yeah.
Okay? And ultimately what happens is that he's still triggered and he has this thing, I don't want to appear stupid. Literally, he doesn't want to appear, oh, I'm not smart enough. And he says, if I'm going to do that, I'm going to make this thing work. I'm not going to let it lose. I'm going to work hard at it. And it sucks him into an emotional
Which is a stick to the guns mentality, in essence.
Yeah, well, and not even he's not even blazing guns. What happens is this is hard. I don't want to feel the shame of not good enough. I'm going to try to work this thing out.
Yeah.
Okay? It's not the blazing guns. Ultimately, okay. though, what you're seeing is that at the very deep level, what really matters is what beliefs about your ability to manage uncertainty
yes.
are being revealed in your trading account.
Yes.
That's what the game's all about. And ultimately, that's where self-mastery, once you realize, oh, this is a probability game where uncertainty is the rule. And all of a sudden you realize it's not really the outcome that I can manage. What happens is it's what mind, what beliefs do I hold that I project onto the markets that I'm seeing assessed by my trading account.
Yeah.
And that's what, in this case, this is what this trader discovered is he said, Randy, I had no idea. I had no idea that this was working at this level.
Yeah.
Because you don't know how to observe. What's going on? Well, you have to learn to observe your belief systems, and he hadn't done that yet.
Yeah,
and it's
right.
revealed that he understood why he didn't want to see. Nobody wants to wake up and go, I look in the mirror and think, I'm stupid. Well, I'm just going to buy into that.
Yeah,
no,
exactly.
You fight it.
Yeah, exactly.
You
and
fight
hence
it.
People always the classic saying, you trade what you believe about the markets, not the markets itself. There's that layer that you put in between you and the actual market. And it's that belief system you end up doing. And his is, I'm going to keep working it out. I'm never going to give it up. You know, it's like a husband in a bad marriage. You know, you'll just never, no matter what is done, he keeps trying to reconcile and work. When someone is actively potentially saying he's wrong or they want out, and they'll do almost
anything.
Yeah,
that didn't work well for me in my first marriage, by the way.
Exactly. Often doesn't. So yeah, that's a different game as well entirely. So that's excellent. Let's go back into the capturing thereof and the stopping the bleeding, the triage, and then the rescue.
Okay. The piece that begs to be put on the table now is the notion of mindfulness. Okay. What we've done at this particular point in time is we've come to a moment of where we have this idea of emotion as biological, and it's something that there is no freedom from emotion, but there is freedom of emotion. And what you're doing is you're learning to manage the emotion so that it doesn't sweep you away. Unfortunately, Francis, that's not going to change. That's not the game changer. You know, I alluded to that in when I was talking about Mike, this trader I work with, is that ultimately Mike can manage the emotions, but that gets him to the door of the mind. Now the job is to say, how do I open that door and look inside and see what in the world, what beliefs are actually functioning at a very primitive, out of awareness level that I'm not aware of, but it's impacting performance. Okay? And that's where mindfulness comes in. And a lot of people really don't grasp mindfulness or what I would call awakening the observer. And the very basic form of mindfulness is to notice.
I love start, that, by the way. Awakening the observer.
Yeah.
The self-observer and the observer within you of self. Yes, it's very good.
It's a big deal. Initially, though, what we're saying is how do we get to awakening observer? What we do is we say, ultimately, I can start noticing stuff. Most of us notice stuff after the fact, okay? Where we do an autopsy on something and we beat the dead horse, but what happens is, what if we were to start noticing stuff in the midst of action. This is where awakening the observer, and all of a sudden you start realizing in the human, what makes the human so different is that we have a faculty called observation, where we actually call it the observing self, where it is like your awareness is separate from your thoughts and your beliefs. And all of a sudden you realize, oh my God, I don't even have thoughts and beliefs. They're having me. Okay? Just like this guy Mike, he had no idea that there was a belief system working underneath his performance of I'm not good enough and I have to work hard, and God forbid if I lose, it'll show that I'm stupid. So you can really see how he's set up to make some really dumb decisions. Because in trading, you're going to take losses.
Yeah.
Okay? It's just part of the game. You're going to minimize those losses, though. So ultimately, in this observing self, you start recognizing that there is a faculty of observation that exists outside of thought and belief.
Yes.
And you begin to realize, oh, really what my brain did
and
is
this
it
the
got
dispassionate. Is this the dispassionate part? In other words,
absolutely.
It's not married to I'm not worthy, I must work harder than everybody else. It's not married to a belief systems, the markets are overvalued, they can only go down. This is a dispassionate observer of self. I just keep repeating the same things. That's kind of observation?
That kind of observation. Actually, as an observer watching the litany of thoughts, like you were just talking about running through mind, the observer would be asking, where does this come from? Who is this speaking?
Yeah.
And ultimately, and particularly in my work, what you discover is that the brain is literally a community of rival emotional programs that literally has duked it out and created a particular functional self.
Yes.
Now, that's what I call the historical self, and it's the one that happened before you could think. You know, your brain gets born into circumstances. It's got a family. It's got a culture. It's got social media. It's got all sorts of things wiring it. And before you know it, voila, there you are. And you think these are your thoughts. You think this is me. No, this is just one potential organization of a self. What's interesting is the brain's doing that on an emotional program level. When this miracle of mind shows up that kind of emerges out of brain, is suddenly those emotional programs, those chemical thoughts, that's what thoughts are. They're biochemical reactions going on between neurons. Suddenly, they're given the voice as your thoughts in your mind. They're not yours. They're thoughts that emerge out of a history, and you've bought into them. You had no reason to ever say, well, let me examine this a little closer. And when you start learning to observe thought, you start going, you know, there's a lot of global assessments running through my head that have absolutely no evidence at all, but I have just been absolutely blind to them. I didn't even know they were there. And they were like a submarine torpedoing me.
Well, as a conspirator, sometimes I would say we get injected with a lot of values systems or belief systems from a childhood, because we all go through this vulnerable phase where we do not have the conscious guardian to the subconscious mind really developed enough to actually be a gatekeeper. And it appears that you end up with a legacy of templates that have been left there that are old, may have served a purpose for stopping you from talking to the strange man when you were a kid playing at the park, but actually doesn't serve any adult purposes. In other words, that aspect of the rocket where it has the big canister to get away from Earth's gravitational pull and then foregoes with that and drops it off and then goes into intermediate state, has a greater, you know, less fuel but still a large amount, and then goes into the lunar module element that is just fit for the purpose of the landing of the particular elements of the spacecraft with the astronauts in it. We do not have the ability to drop those stages that we no longer need. It's like the milk teeth. Are we a legacy? Are we stuck with legacies of templates, of injected archetypes that were designed to protect us, maybe from our parents instilled in us, events, traumas, and various things that, as you quite correctly say, aren't you, but they're things that we've kind of come to accept without question anymore.
Yeah, that's what the observer is needed for, because ultimately, like in this example I gave about Mike, that's something that he grew up in. He had no idea. It was just normal to him. It was like being a fish in water. You don't notice the water. Now, a fish notices when he gets in air, because that's really different. Okay? And ultimately, what happens is you begin to say, I need to start taking a look at the historical organization of a self that I'm bringing to the trading arena. And that's what Mike had the opportunity of doing, is that all of a sudden, voila, there is a piece of historical self. And understand, this guy has been a very successful business guy. This is not about, am I successful or not? Is something wrong? No, a lot of things went right. Ultimately, though, he switched domains. You know, what was successful in one domain, say business, suddenly, when you start to try to use the same success formula, hard work, never giving up, in trading this new domain, the rules didn't apply anymore. So what you're doing, you're saying, I need to start taking a look at the historical wiring here that allowed me success in one domain but isn't helping me in this domain. I need to start really sorting it out. I do that by observation. You know, you step back, you begin to recognize that, you know, you can actually learn to step back and start noticing literally what's going on inside the mind. It's not that difficult. Once you realize that this is all about self-preservation.
How do we get good at that? Because it's my belief that most people are deeply unders on the self-awareness category and the mindfulness. How do we get to practice that we are continually able to promptly and recognize that it's time for second observer, and to have him triggered and sat on that right shoulder and looking at ourselves and saying, why are you actually having those thoughts? On what basis is that? Is that rationally determined or in it? How do we get more into the habit? How do we incorporate this as a greater degree of our life? Because this is going to change our lives in all ways, but particularly for trading. But how do we practice getting better at that?
First of all, recognize that it's a skill.
Yes.
That can be developed, and that marketing and advertising of today, the one thing that they don't want you to do is to develop the observing self. Otherwise, they wouldn't have very much to sell. Okay?
So conspicuous consumption in our current globalist mentality and model very much relies on instant gratification and Pavlovian responses, is what you're saying. And this is straight out of the Bernays school of marketing and triggering emotional responses. They need you in emotional brain. They want to fast track you to the low road part of your decision-making process. Right. Because that sees you buy a whole bunch of junk that later on you think, why have I got that?
Yeah, and most of those, what we're talking about in the book Blink, what you discover is that you're making decisions based on emotional brain, not on rational brain. What happens is the rational brain produces an alibi that makes it rational that you have that product. I can't tell you. I was talking to a family the other day that in where I live in Charlotte, North Carolina, there are these guys buy these enormously large pickup trucks that are just monsters.
Yeah.
And what happens is you see middle-aged guys like myself, you know, they got their little pudgy belly and all that kind of stuff, and they're climbing into these machines.
Yeah.
And they are just in pristine condition. They've never done a lick of work. But when they get in that truck, rev it up, they feel manly. They feel power.
Yeah.
That's a $70,000 truck to get a kick of testosterone, okay? Ultimately, what they're doing is you're saying, okay, what we'll do, you don't really
I know the ones, Rand. I know the ones. I've been to the States. They're the one with the twin axle at the back with the two wheels on both sides, the Ford F-650 type kind. I know him. I said, what are these guys doing? That thing must do about 7 miles to the gallon. And it does look like they're semi-truck drivers. You need a ladder to get up them.
Yeah, they're manly. They look manly, and you feel the manliness. But ultimately, you have to buy the product to keep maintaining the revving up of the manliness, the warrior, the courage inside there. Ultimately, what you discover inside that is a sense of powerlessness. Okay? And it would be easier to go in on an observational level to say, you know something? What I'm going to do is I'm going to turn toward that discomfort of the powerlessness, and I'm going to transform that because I realize it's just a conversation. It's just a pattern that has been learned by my brain that's producing mine. And in trading, what you discover is that, you know, you're no longer hiding from the demons. The demons are stalking you. These guys in the pickup trucks, you know, they'll go on forever. Okay? In trading, man, it catches up with you immediately. If you have a sense of powerlessness,
yeah,
and you don't have your big truck to trade from, you're face to face with your sense of powerlessness.
Yeah.
How do you begin to observe it? And like with this guy, Mike, understand, he learned, you know, with some coaching, with one-on-one coaching, he learned to observe what he had not seen.
How did he learn that? Let's get into brass tacks and detail. How do I help, and how do you and I help people suddenly understand that they need to learn this and how to do it? How do we get them?
The need's very simple. Look at your trading account and decide whether or not the way you're functioning right now, is it working? Is it growing? Or is it...
Yeah, they'll say any number of reasons. They'll try a new method. They'll try a new this. They'll try a new widget. They'll buy a new black box. They'll do whatever. And then they'll keep going through the cycle. They'll blow their way through 10 accounts, and then they'll fail, and they'll run away, and they won't come back. And we've lost them to the personal development program that is trading. We've lost them to actually the real development side. But let's say we get somebody who recognizes that he needs to develop self, and he recognizes this is the challenge, a bigger challenge than he realized. He can't crack every nut with the nut hammer. This is a souffle. He has to cut it with a cake knife. How do we get him to switch tools and to practice the new skills required for cake slicing instead of nut cracking?
Yeah. Well, the first thing is he has to want it bad enough to deconstruct his comfort zone.
Yes.
Okay, that's the first thing.
Many don't. They think it's too hard, or I don't get it.
Most human beings don't. And what happens is they need to get jobs. They need to do something else. They need to find out where their skills can work other than in trading, because in trading, you really truly are responsible for the mind that you're bringing in to manage uncertainty. And you have a black and white truth meter, your trading account, that's telling you. And what happens is that I teach mindfulness. I have a number of different ways of teaching it, but I use guided meditations initially, where I'm getting them to start noticing thought.
Yes.
And I have
In the meditation? So in the meditation, they'll go, recognize that you're having a thought. Do you let it go and let it pass? Do they hold on to it? What is the...
No. What happens at first, I'm teaching them that thoughts arise, and what happens is the observer fuses to it and it takes you away. What I'm initially doing is teaching them that thoughts arise, they have a life, and they're just going to move on to downfield, and you don't have to attach to them. You can sit and watch them and not become consumed by them. And you notice that it's really hard at first because you're so used to just getting sucked into thought and to getting them away. But once you do that, you're beginning to ask the question, at least in the way I teach mindfulness, is I'm not interested in them just noticing that thoughts arise and have a life and disappear back into the void. I'm interested in them going, I know, what is this thought saying? Okay, that's the first thing. What is it really saying? And by this time, I've taught them how to slow the thought down, like almost like a rheostat, slow it down with your breath. And then you're saying, well, what is it saying? And you're going to get a lot of stuff like, you'll never do it. You might as well. It's just like with this guy. I was with Mike. This guy, Mike, is that, you know, I'm really stupid. I really haven't got it. You know, I'm going to have to cover it up with work. What he's doing is he's finally slowed it down, going, oh, my God, I never saw that. And instead of turning away from that, going, oh, man, I don't want anybody to know that. I don't want to know that. You're going, oh, man, this is just one potential organization of self, and it's really hindering my ability to perform. And in doing that, you begin to observe it and you're beginning to ask the critical questions. Not only is what is this thought saying, but what emotional program is it attached to? And Francis, that is key because it takes you back to these emotional programs that have organized you into a self. And almost all of them are based around fear. They're based around your brain being a negative assessment machine. And there's a part that is highly destructive living within you. I call it the inner critic. And you need to learn how to observe that thing. When you beat yourself up on a trade, you know, and you just beat. I have never found a trader who has become a better trader by beating themselves up.
Yeah,
never.
You don't beat yourself up to being a better trader. You have to forgive yourself regardless of the sum that people have lost. And I've come across people who've lost six-digit sums and even larger, and some that have lost as percentages of their net worth, substantial percentages of their net worth. But you've got to live with that which you've created and go forward from it.
The beating self up, when you look at that, you begin to say, oh, this is the inner critic.
Yes.
This isn't me. This is in the inner critic, that the destructive. There is destruction within the human species. There was a wonderful, there have been experiments done at UCLA and Stanford where literally they brought in kids, pretty upper middle class kids, I mean, good healthy kids, and they turned them into destructive machines within 2 days. Really powerful stuff. And you begin to realize, oh, that potentiality lives within all of us. Yes, it does. And in trading, it's exposed. When you start hearing the inner critic, you're hearing that destructive part of ourselves, the yin yang, that destructive quality. It can't be, you can't make it disappear, but you can certainly become aware of it and recognize that that's not a part of the self that you want to feed.
Yeah. Don't feed that monkey.
This is what observation is so powerful about. Suddenly you realize, going, oh, these are just thoughts running through my mind. And what happens is I have an uncontrolled mind. If you view the mind as a committee with various forces and there's a
power
struggle.
Which brings me to my favorite phrase, developing the suitable and balanced committee of the mind with all the best archetypes. The critic serves a purpose to highlight to you when there's been an adverse event, maybe, but he mustn't be empowered to thrash you and for you to go into self-mawkish navel-gazing and self-flagellating depression, and that's totally non-productive regardless what you've done. So we've got to recognize, okay, we didn't do so well there. We need to analyze where it went wrong and how it all happened. Take the lesson. That's it. It's not you idiot, you twit, you fool, you're always never going to amount to anything, da-da-da-da-da. Repeat any parental teacher or any other overbearing naysayer that once forecast some doom or amounting to nothing on yourself. And we all store these disses up when we're young. So the critic must can be contained. Let's talk about the other characters in the – or is this session three? You need to tell me now, Rand, in terms
of – I would rather focus on the mindfulness itself. What I'm asking people to do is to start noticing their thoughts, start noticing their body, start noticing that their body and their thoughts are deeply connected.
But noticing them is one thing. Okay, outside my window there's a tree and there might be a bird in another one. What do they do? What is there something to be done with them? Is there an analysis or is it just there's a thought? It's not me. It might be me. It might be inaccurate. It might be justified.
It goes back to the sequence. What you're doing is you're asking, okay, well, what emotional program does that come from? What's the emotion?
Excellent. Okay. So can I stop right there? When I look at the economic system and some politician or lobby group makes a statement, I'm always asking, who does he represent? That is his message, but who pays him and who does he represent? I don't just go, oh, wow, another fact given to me by a politician. That's awesome. I must remember that and regurgitate it. I always try to understand from whence does it come? Who is the source? And he serves a person who is paying him, funding him, or a job that he has, as much as he may be imparting information or even disinformation and deception. So in terms of that focus, we should be doing the same with the thoughts then. From whence do you come?
It is a, if you take a look at your mind, it is a fractal to what's happening like in a corporate boardroom. Okay? Yeah. Is you realize there is a struggle going on if it's not a well-managed boardroom. And it starts with the observer waking up and recognizing, oh, my God, there's a power struggle going on here. It's a mess in here. And I need to clean up house and reorganize this committee into a higher functioning entity and a higher functioning self. That's the purpose, at least the way I defined it, of mindfulness, of awakening the observer. Is you start waking up and you realize that it's kind of like what the Buddhists say, is that, you know, every time you step into a stream, you never step into the same stream.
No.
In the same way with your identity as I, is as you move through
life. Different set of cells, it's different water molecules. Yeah, I get that.
Right. And even, and what happens, you have to really come to the conclusion that Rene Descartes was wrong. I think, therefore I am, is no. What happens is that your thoughts just, if you identify with them, what you're doing is you're saying you're owned by your history. And by the way, Descartes actually rescinded what he said later in his life. And he realized that emotions were the powerful thing that pushed thought. But nobody wanted to hear that. The age of reason and the ability of not having to feel emotions had arisen. And before you know it, the scientific revolution had happened. And
it's like anything in any particular period. It has phases where one is the deemed preeminence and gets over-egged to the expense of other more central drivers. And I think in what you're saying is in your field, everything became all about thought.
Right.
Not about the biology.
Well, actually, kind of therapy, CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, holds that thought comes first and emotion comes out of thought.
Yeah.
We know that to be so wrong today. We know that emotion rises and thought comes out of emotion now.
Yeah. I use that analogy. It's almost like thought is a plant and it needs the soil, and the emotion is the soil. The soil has to be there first. No seed will germinate. So the whole concept is fascinating, and it was one that was a little bit new for me, even though it's probably well established in your field. So if we start questioning our thoughts and recognizing, it seems that one of the key points is the thought isn't you. So you have to look at it as if it's a stranger in your own home and say, who are you? How did you get here? And what is your justification? What feeds you? What's brought you here? This is fascinating. I mean, I would love out of this meeting, if we could get 7 steps, bullet points written down from you. That say, here are the things people need to realize. And, you know, I don't know whether number one is, you are not your thoughts, for example. Number two is, take your time out and observe these thoughts and scrutinize them. Submit them to a rational process. From whence do they come? Does it come from some belief system, some chip on your shoulder, some traumatic event that it always seems to provoke every time you're in a situation where you're doing something wrong? Does this inner critic come wading in with a baseball bat ready to throw a bucket of vomit over you all the time? You know, put him back in his chair. You made a mistake. It's not the end of the world. I had a time where I used to be very strict on myself and call myself an idiot all the time if I did simple things wrong. And I had to stem that. And I don't know, not through this discussion with you, because it was a little bit earlier, but I recognized that. But I was also, you know, I had someone in my life at that point, and they said, you know, you do that a lot. And then you go, actually, I do. And I don't need to be so hard on myself. And it's interesting having that. I needed the external person to actually say you're way too hard on yourself at certain times. And since then, I've developed that now as someone who's largely alone here, to recognize that I have to be my own guardian in that respect, and I do. What else would we put on that 7-point bullet list? Because I'd love to have you technically draw it out, and then maybe if we could exchange an email, I could attach it to this clip. The 7 must-do things for developing your mindfulness.
Well, the first thing is breathe.
Breathe.
The
deep
thing is,
properly. Not.
No, that you the very first thing, because what happens that interrupts stuff, and understand that observer is kickstarted by questions. And
Yes.
that's why you're going, what are these thoughts running into mind? What organization is here? And out of that question, you begin to see. And then what, as your body's calm, what you're doing is you're saying, okay, thoughts arise. However they thought arise, if they're visual, if they're auditory, or if they're feeling, start noticing the content of thought. And you start saying, well, what is this thought actually saying? And Francis, people start finding the craziest things. They find these global, massive negative assessments running around in their head that there's absolutely no evidence for. Okay? And so you're just beginning to become alert to what's running around in your head anyway.
So is there a
Okay?
bit of time to self-love yourself a bit as well? If people, is it safe to, I suspect many people are quite hard on the self-critic, not necessarily to the same degree, but we are over-vigilant when we make mistakes on, maybe discipline. Maybe that's me prejudging my own experience, but I've heard you mention it. People always are trying to compensate for something and not letting themselves be. It's kind of an acceptance of self and a degree of self-love.
Yeah, there actually now is a whole section of neuroscience that is rooted in compassion as an emotion. And there's a couple pioneers in it, and what they basically discovered, if you want to change a belief system that a poorly functioning belief system, is that it's not the courage, it's not the ruler in you, it is the compassion, the self-compassion in you that changes the belief.
The healer, basically. The
The
healer
healer, yeah.
can soothe you to a new way with soft hands. It's with soft hands that you find the new path, not with you don't get thrashed there.
Yeah, what you do is you recognize that all human beings have struggle, okay? Whether or not it's suffering or not, that depends on you. In trading, a lot of traders find themselves suffering quite a bit when they take a look at their how much they lose and stuff like that. The real key into that suffering, what mind are you bringing? If you're bringing a mind that is going, get up, get tough, stuff, tough upper lip, you're going to continue the same junk. The pattern just reinforces it. If you bring compassion, recognizing that, yeah, this hurts, and that a mistake has been made, and we need to learn from that mistake. But the first is that you're okay. You're okay. You as a human being are okay. You and your performances are not the same. And you begin to realize, and what they've discovered is that compassion actually will take the neurocircuitry of a self-limiting belief and detangle it, deconstruct it, and will organize it into higher functioning. And that's where the loving kindness has really had an enormous impact upon various therapeutic models of today. Is they're realizing that, yeah, you really need to be kind. It doesn't mean being a wimp. It just means that you're recognizing that, all human beings
And as an
struggle.
alpha male dominated trading environment where it is, yeah, kick ass, jump in, knock, chase the market up, and all of that stuff, it's a difficult sell for people to accept that they need to come in with the compassion hands to really get shift in
Well, it
terms
depends on how
of,
much money you want to lose, Francis.
yeah.
Unless you have enough money to move a market, okay? And there
Very few
are
do.
market makers, okay? I have a couple friends who were market makers during their stuff, and what happens is they can move an enormous amount of money around, and they can make markets happen. If you, and I'm assuming that the people that we're working with
No.
aren't that league. What happens is otherwise. Go ahead and check it out. Take your alpha ways and apply it to trading and find out if it works or not. I can promise you that it
No, it's not
won't,
working. Yeah,
not long term.
we don't need to go too far down that road,
Yeah.
for most people, in my view. Yeah, so good, good, good. Rand, this has been fascinating. The development of mindfulness. I'm going to press you, if you don't mind, to do me 7 bullets on an email. Would you, if you could do that? Seven. Rand Howells, 7 key commandments. And if 7's the wrong number, you make it the right number, whatever it is. Because this has been a great, great session. We talked about stopping the bleeding, in essence, which doesn't stop the crisis situation, but it stops you from getting any worse.
Right.
And then how to intercede with it and how to bring in the mindfulness after a first session, which went a long way to understanding the problem. What will we cover in final session number 3, Rand? Where will you take us?
Okay, understand that to me, mindfulness, awakening the observer, is a tool.
Yes.
Okay. It's a tool to begin to realize, oh my God, there is an enormous potential here, and the observer of that potential is what gives form to that potential.
Yes.
What we're now going to do is we're going to take, okay, now we've learned how to observe. What yes. we're going to do is we're going to learn how to build the mind from being able to observe.
Yes.
We're just not observing the one you came with. Now it's
observing
really
about, is just the beginning. Observing is just the beginning. So we get to see what's in the room for the first time. We stand outside ourselves and we say, right, this is the place. And there are places where it could be tidier. We're going to reform this in a manner that creates the perfect committee of the mind that sees rationality be the order of the day, sees us be compassionate to ourselves when we slip up, sees us be within ourselves when we've done good and not losing our heads. This is going to be a great session, session number 3. I can't wait for it. And what I'm also going to do is I'm going to do those, put up your bullets when you send. Any passing and final words on mindfulness? Because this has been the mindfulness session.
Well, what I would say is this, is that if you have not started a mindfulness practice, do it now. Is that...
And what does that mean to some people? Some guy will go, a mindfulness practice. What do I do? Do I start meditating? Do I start thinking about my thoughts in a second person kind
of
way?
A really good place to start is Jon Kabat-Zinn. He was a pioneer of moving Zen-like meditations of becoming witness to thought into cancer treatment. And, you know, as he grew and as his work grew and the survival rates started really magnifying that, boy, there's something going on with this mindfulness. There was a branching out. But Jon Kabat-Zinn is the guy who introduced an Eastern concept of mindfulness into Western society. Yeah. And everybody owes him a debt of gratification for that. But that's a good place to start. You can go to my website.
So let's have that name again, Rand, and I'll
Jon
ask that you also... One more time.
Jon Kabat-Zinn, and Kabat-Zinn is one of his affinated last names.
Jon Kabat-Zinn, and the
yeah.
book is?
Oh, gosh. Just type in his name, and there are books upon books upon books.
Yeah.
The other thing that you might want to do is on my website, I actually have a couple quite excellent mindfulness guided meditations that start helping you to awaken that observer within the self. And,
You did send all your, I don't know if you sent all, but you sent a series of webinars that I've all packed onto the podcast, meditations, my apologies. So was it in that suite that you sent that had images as well with the stones and the water ripples and the, there were quite a few.
Yeah,
there were meditation for different points, meditation for pulling the trigger, meditation for, they were events driven.
Yeah, those are there. Those are that they might be there.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, good. Because I will make those available in the links for this YouTube clip that we do and for the podcast as well. Excellent. Rand Howe, what a great session. Thank you so, so much. All the way from Colorado, where the men drive big, big trucks with huge axles and big wheels to prove that they're still men. And Rand is in his Toyota Prius, I expect, keeping it real. Thank you very, very much for that. That was really awesome. Thoroughly enjoyed it. Really mindful as well. What a game changer to learn mindfulness. And on our third session, we're going to go into, now that we're mindful, now that we're observing, let's in a calm, rational way, analyze that which we see and make adjustments so that we can be more efficient and more rational.
It's a game.
Excellent. Thank you, Rand. I have a great week ahead. I'll get on to processing the new week and getting it out to our audience. Speak to you soon.
Okay. Have a great one. Take care.
All the best. Enjoy the weekend.